Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. We're Professor Anne Tiernan makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She is Professor in the Centre for Governance and Public Policy at Griffith University and Director of Postgraduate and Executive Programs in Policy, Analysis and Public Administration at Griffith's School of Government and International Relations. Professor Tiernan is the author of several books, including Lessons in Governing, A Profile of Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, and The Gatekeepers, Lessons from the Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, both MUP books, and Learning to Be a Minister, Heroic Expectations, Practical Realities, with Professor Patrick Weller, and Power Without Responsibility, Ministerial Staffers in Australian Governments, from Whitlam to Howard. Professor Tiernan is a member of the Public Records Review Committee of the Queensland State Archives, and between 2008 and 2012 she was a member of the Board of Commissioners of the Queensland Public Service Commission, and she's here tonight to talk about her most recent book, The Gatekeepers, Lessons from Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff. Professor Tiernan, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Jared and Anne and Cynthia. Cynthia, thanks to the Sydney Institute for your interest in the book on Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff that I published with my colleague Professor Rod Rhodes in mid-2014. In fact, there's two books. This is a bit confusing. An academic volume, Lessons in Governing, A Profile of Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, and then a trade version, The Gatekeepers, aimed at a general readership, both published by MUP. There is a widespread view that academic books equals turgid and unreasonable and unreadable, so maybe unreasonable too. That's why there are two different titles. So tonight's seminar is an opportunity to discuss in detail eight lessons that the cohort of 11 Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff who participated in our study told us they learned from their experience of the job. And just to contextualise and frame those lessons, I first need to provide some background to the study of Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, including a summary of our methodology and approach, that's quite important, a brief overview of how the job has evolved since its formal emergence in 1972. I'll then report how those who have done the job describe the work of the Chief of Staff, their views of how and why it might have changed over its recent history. And I'll move then to the eight lessons before offering some reflections on the problems that have bedeviled our three most recent Prime Ministers, I think. And these have been widely attributed, as many of you will know, to the capacity and performance of successive PMOs and, by implication, recent Prime Ministers' Chiefs of Staff. And, of course, then I look forward to opening it to discussion with a very impressive crowd that's assembled tonight, so thank you. Now, people may know that in the US, or may have read that in the US, the job of Chief of Staff to the President has been described as the javelin catcher. And this acknowledges the challenging and unpredictable nature of the issues that Chief of Staff will need to deal with every day. It also acknowledges that by the time an issue has reached the Chief of Staff, it's because no one else in the system has been able to solve it. So the stakes and the expectations are high. Now, we know this, don't we, because we watched Leo McGarry do the job for seven seasons of Aaron Sorkin's The West Wing. Numerous books and articles have been written on President's Chiefs of Staff, including by the people who have done it. Now, the phrase coined by the participants in our study to characterise their work as PM's Chief of Staff is pest controller and shock absorber. And in fact, that's what I wanted to call the book, but MUP wouldn't let me. So this vivid and quintessentially Australian metaphor captures what Chiefs of Staff do to support and protect the Prime Minister, both the office and the person who holds the office. They run a PMO that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and which, under Tony Abbott, numbered 58 staff. So that's a very significant increase over time that I can talk about if you like. The Chief of Staff works far from the public eye in the shadows of Australian politics, although in the past 15 years or so, and I think perhaps in the last 5 years or so particularly, they've become increasingly public figures. They attract very significant media and public scrutiny. Their performance is seen as inextricably linked to the performance of their Prime Minister and whether he or she is effective. The Prime Minister's Chief of Staff is the hub of a court or network supporting Prime Ministers. They're a pivotal point at which the political and the administrative meet. Now, despite its undoubted significance, very little is known about how Chiefs of Staff do their job in Australia. The individuals who've been appointed to the job have very little by way of advice and experience to draw on in contemplating how they might help their Prime Minister to make a successful transition to government or to establish systems and arrangements that will enable them to govern effectively. Insights and advice have passed from previous incumbents, but this has been episodic and generally has occurred along partisan lines. Now, I'm among a very small and ageing group of Australian scholars whose interest is in the work of governing and politics. Some of you might have seen my earlier work on staffers. And among other things, that research introduced me to the presidential studies literature and to the extensive work done there to understand the executive office of the presidency and the key staff positions that support the president. I was impressed that there, chiefs of staff had twice come together to talk about the job and its challenges from all sides, both sides of the partisan divide. Those studies were explicitly aimed at helping incoming presidents to make a successful transition to government and to hit the ground running, as they like to say. So in our terms, they were building the institutional memory of the Prime Minister's, of the White House office. And institutional memory, of course, in our system is assumed to exist in the public service. It resides in the career public service, which in theory at least provides continuity of administration and knowledge of what's gone before. Institutional memory, though, is inherently absent in partisan organisations like the ones that serve American presidents. Now, there are concerns, and there's quite a big and developing body of literature about institutional memory in Westminster-style systems, particularly those like Australia's that have become hybridised. And what I mean by that awful word is that that's where responsibility for advising and supporting ministers is shared between private officers and career bureaucrats. So I was interested to see whether the American methodology could be adapted for the Australian context. So our study aimed to build a nuanced understanding of the Chief of Staff role from the perspective of those who had done it. We, as researchers and the Chief of Staff who participated, proceeded from the shared premise that what they had learned in the job might help a future Chief of Staff. Now, given the gap between what's written and their first-hand knowledge of life in Prime Minister's offices, our study was intended to provide an opportunity for Chief of Staff to record in their own words what it was like to be there. They could draw lessons to pass on to future Chiefs of Staff and others working in or aspiring to a similar position. So in late 2009 then, with funding support from the Australia and New Zealand School of Government Research Program, 11 former Chiefs of Staff to Prime Ministers spanning governments from Fraser to Rudd came together to participate in two closed roundtable workshops. Each session was interested to elicit participants' views on the following topics. How had the job developed and evolved? How had different individuals approached the task of working with the Prime Minister? What were the key duties and responsibilities that they performed? What were some of the challenges and issues confronting Chiefs of Staff at different stages of the governing cycle? And that turns out to be quite important. And what lessons might they pass on to their successor? Now, between 1972 and June 2013, when our study ended, 24 individuals had held the Chief of Staff position. That number's now about 27. Seven attended the first focus group in Canberra in September 2009. These were Dale Budd and David Kemp, who'd worked for Fraser, Graham Evans, who worked for Hawke, Don Russell and Geoff Walsh, who'd been Chief of Staff to Paul Keating, Graham Morris and Arthur Sinodinos, who, of course, people here will know, worked for John Howard. A second focus group was held later in Sydney in December, and that was attended by four Chiefs of Staff, Sandy Holway, who'd worked for Hawke, Alan Hawke, who'd worked briefly for Keating, Nicole Feely, who'd worked for Howard, and David Epstein, who had by then left working for Rudd. My colleague Pat Weller, who some of you will know, helped facilitate those focus groups. We were working at the time on our Learning to be a Minister book. Now, people were clear that we could record and transcribe their proceedings. So I might skip over the research design, but I'm happy to take questions about it. The important point is this. This is not a bunch of academics talking about the job of Chief of Staff. This was an opportunity for the Chiefs of Staff to explain in their own words, and the methods that we used enabled their voices to come out. Because if we're applying our analytical categories, we'll miss the subtleties and nuances of this group, and they had a great deal in common. That theoretical point has been lost on at least one generalist reviewer, but anyway, I persist with this important methodological note that it's actually their account of what they thought they were doing in this job. So what did they tell us? What did we learn from more than 9 hours of discussions and 230 pages of transcripts? I should note that the focus groups were a key, but they weren't our only research strategy. The events of June 2010 had a significant implications for the project and the book that, as I'd originally envisaged it. We had a lot of follow-up work to do to capture the period between 2010 and 2013, and I can talk a bit more about that if you like. Publishers were really much more interested in what had gone wrong in the Rudd and Gillard years than they were in the development and evolution of the Chief of Staff job, it might not surprise you to work out. However, I just want to talk briefly. You know, we managed to come to terms with that, and that's dealt with in the book, and I'll explain how. So I'll just talk briefly about the development and evolution of the job, and that'll take me to lessons. Our Chiefs of Staff identified 6 stages in the evolution of the Chief of Staff position. And we argue that from 1905 to 1980, the public service model was predominant. Now, there were sporadic efforts after that to redefine the work of the Prime Minister's office under Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser. And those early changes led to a more expansive conception of supporting the Prime Minister in Fraser's final term from 1980 to 83. Now, under Bob Hawke, the Chief of Staff remained an experienced senior public servant, whose wide range of managerial responsibilities included ensuring that the advice provided by an expanded Prime Minister's office complemented the advice from public service departments. Now, in more recent practice under Prime Ministers Keating, Howard, Rudd and Gillard, the Chief of Staff assumed greater responsibility for coordination across government and developed a strong political rather than managerial focus. I'd venture that the same is probably true for Tony Abbott's office, but that's for the second edition. Our respondents agreed that 1991 represented a turning point in the Chief of Staff job. While the Howard period is understood as the triumph of the political, but it's very important to understand that Chiefs of Staff explain that a broad connotation of political is essential to understanding the support needs of present-day Prime Ministers. Their primarily political focus encompasses coordination in the endless quest for coherence amidst the fragmentation and complexity of network governance and handling the many dependencies that Prime Ministers find themselves encountering. So our 6 stages in the development of the Chief of Staff role reflect the centralisation of authority and duties in the Prime Minister's office and the politicisation of the appointment. But they also reflect Prime Minister's efforts to evolve strategies to cope with domestic and international pressures and their burgeoning dependencies. Now, importantly, there is no job description for the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff. People have improvised and reinvented the job according to the needs and sometimes the whims of their Prime Minister. They perform many tasks. These include, according to the Chiefs of Staff, protecting the Prime Minister, running the office, crisis management, controlling the agenda, policy coordination and political management. In the book, we deal with those jobs in 2 chapters, one on protecting the Prime Minister, the other on managing the repertoire according to the personality and style of the PM and his or her needs at their different phases of their tenure. Now, there are continuities from one Prime Minister to another. In fact, there's very significant continuities from one Prime Minister to another. But equally, there are important differences associated with Prime Ministerial style. And moreover, each Chief of Staff brings to the position their own conception of the job. The challenge and the art for them, then, is to manage the mix. And there's a premium on getting the right fit for a particular Prime Minister at a particular time. Now, the West Wing television series popularised the tradition that an outgoing president writes a letter to his replacement. It's left in the Oval Office for the new incumbent to read on inauguration, if you remember. In Series 7. We asked Chiefs of Staff to reflect on mistakes they had made and lessons that they'd learned from their time in the job and to write a metaphorical memo to their successor. We asked them what advice and wisdom they would pass on. Now, the Chiefs of Staff identified 8 lessons. I'll cover them briefly here before turning to what we think, and I think recent experience suggests, is the most significant of these lessons, and that is the urgent need to preserve institutional memory. So lesson 1 is to know the boss. There are many ways of supporting and protecting the Prime Minister and the person in the office. Our Chiefs of Staff accounts of working with PM stress contingency, particularly personality and working style, individual preferences and strengths. Always it was the leader who set the tone. The arrangements and processes described were framed by Chiefs of Staff as attempts to provide what the Prime Minister needed or wanted from his or her Prime Minister's office. Lesson two was to run the office. And this issue has become much more important as the PMO has grown in size and has become much more functionally specialised, dispersed and responsible for coordination. Now, US presidents learned in the 1970s that growing personal staff capacities must themselves be coordinated and managed. Australian political leaders have actually been pretty slow to understand their organisational imperative. Running the office covers the routines for managing the diary and paper, a clear allocation of responsibilities between the public service and the private office, and among members of the PMO, not always easy or well done. It includes recruiting the necessary array of talent and of managing the mix. But the first and most critical task for any Prime Minister is to choose their Chief of Staff. Now, aside from Hawke, whose choice of senior officials as Chief of Staff was deliberate and pretty effective in fashioning advisory arrangements that suited his personality and style, recent Australian Prime Ministers have appointed people they know and trust to the Chief of Staff position. That's hardly surprising. Many of the Chiefs of Staff in our sample, though, had background and experience, at least some, in government, although Arthur Sunnudinus is the last Chief of Staff to have had much experience in the bureaucracy. Now, as we discuss in the book, the career path really matters. The demise of what I'd call the public service career trajectory has significant but not well understood implications. Political parties really provide no learning or preparation for government during the long years in opposition, whereas for previous generations, working in the public service provided an opportunity for their careers to continue to grow and develop. No such grounding or pathway is available for the politically appointed Chief of Staff. Now, the demise of the career pathway has other implications that have become increasingly obvious, I think, under the three most recent Australian Prime Ministers. Chiefs of Staff with bureaucratic or management experience acknowledge the importance of administrative processes in helping the Prime Minister's office to cope with the sheer volume of work. Alternatively, it might include developing processes for deciding the priority of briefs and correspondence with which a Prime Minister must deal. And it really is like drinking from a fire hydrant, so those processes are absolutely critical. The Chiefs of Staff also emphasise the importance of clearly defined responsibilities, not only in the PMO, but between Prime Ministers and their office and the public service. Dale Budd, Graham Evans and Sandy Holway describe the Chief of Staff job as being one of co-equals with senior staff in the Prime Minister's office. All three stress the importance of not getting in the way of the specialists and the need for the Chief of Staff to adjudicate between some very big personalities, all of whom are competing for the affection of the Prime Minister. Now, it's a challenge for the Chief of Staff if the specialists have different ideas, but getting in the way is something that all of the Chiefs of Staff talked about. Lesson three, then, was being here tomorrow, coping and survival. Now, the PMO is political, and it's shaped by perceived political imperatives. That's no surprise. But no matter how much attention is devoted to developing support for the Prime Minister, events will prevail. As a political office, there's a core belief in coping with the changes that affect the PM, with coordinating the networks across government. The Chiefs of Staff, as I mentioned, stress that politics is broadly connoted. The art is coping. The aim is survival and re-election. Graham Morris talked about the importance of continuity and calm. Other Chiefs of Staff agreed. Cool heads are needed, as are, they say, the ability to distinguish between an issue and a crisis. Lesson four is focus on priorities. This covers ensuring that Prime Ministers have an opportunity to focus on the things they want to do and establishing a limited number of priorities to act as a strategic guide for the government. David Kemp was very influential on this thinking in the Fraser years. Alan Hawke enjoined his successors to make sure that you and the Prime Minister get to do at least one thing per week that you want to do, that you don't get overtaken by events. They're keen to do it. It's hard to do. Lesson five, then, is to control the agenda. Unexpected crises and events are inevitable. Day-to-day pressures and demands overwhelm efforts to take a longer-term view. However, agenda control is paramount. Arthur Sinodinos told us that the Howard government learned from the setbacks of 1997 that it had to keep dominating the agenda, using the power of incumbency to do that. Other Chiefs of Staff agreed. Controlling the agenda, though, requires a Prime Minister to maintain a balance between priorities and commitments. The lesson for the Chief of Staff is to find a way of striking this balance and of reorienting and refocusing when unexpected events blow people off course, or of recovering the initiative, as Arthur Sinodinos describes it. Lesson six, then, is to get the right people in the room. Sandy Holway's advice to a future Chief of Staff was, and I quote, "Never be the sole point of contact to the Prime Minister. It's about turning the switches and letting the right people and getting the right people in the room at the right time. Of course, it's not just getting the right people in the right room at the right time, it's also about keeping others out. This is the pest controller dimension of the chief of staff role. Sometimes it's ministers who need to be reminded what they can and can't do. But it is very risky for a chief of staff if they're seen to interpose themselves between ministers and the prime minister and to overstep the bounds of acceptable behaviour for an unelected staffer. Lesson seven, then, is to manage dependencies, and this is a critical thing. And the lesson's easily illustrated. This time by Graham Morris. He talked about how Howard used to place great importance on the party room meeting, on the cabinet, on the leadership meetings, and on the tactics meetings. So, according to Morris, you sort of had three big touch points most days, and certainly most weeks with the colleagues. The Labor caucus is one example of keeping in touch with the colleagues. As both Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard learned, its factional leaders can't be ignored. But we know now the same is true for the coalition, where colleagues in the Liberal and National Party rooms need to be kept on side, and that's a big job for the Prime Minister's office in making sure that that happens. The need to preserve institutional memory is Lesson 8, and it's really our contribution to the lessons for Chiefs of Staff. Its importance was noted by some, but only in passing. Graham Morris observed, "I think a sense of corporate history is really important in the office." Kevin Rudd, you'll remember, when reflecting on his torrid experience in office, also thought he should have paid more attention to institutional wisdom. We think much more needs to be done to preserve institutional memory. Now, the decisions of successive Australian Prime Ministers to shift their main source of advice and support from PM&C to the PMO and to the staff to staff the PMO with personal loyalists often from outside the public service has had marked effects on the centre's institutional memory. And as I mentioned, partisan organisations are inherently, indeed deliberately, temporary. They exist to serve a particular Prime Minister and are staffed mostly by the people selected by them. PMO staffer backgrounds and preparations for the job differs from the traditional career pathway, and besides, their tenure is bound to that of the Prime Minister who chooses them. Now, there's lots of issues with that in terms of partisan organisations lacking storage locations for institutional memory that are available to organisations that are more stable and continuing. These include things like the experience and knowledge of existing staff, technical systems, electronic databases and various kinds of paper records, the management system, comprising organisational routines and standard operating procedures developed and refined through experience. Nor do temporary organisations inherit the beliefs and practices of long-established ones, which provide some certainty and an element of continuity. So instead, they rely on the beliefs and aspirations of the Prime Minister and other key individuals, and perhaps the partisan tradition of how a Labor or a Liberal Prime Minister approaches the task of governing. So at the change of government, each new Prime Minister's office starts afresh, perhaps not even aware that institutional amnesia is built into their design. And the likelihood of pathologies associated with organisational forgetting have increased because the flow of departmental offices to ministerial offices has declined. The Members of Parliament Staff Act did not remove, as intended, the taint of partisanship that came from working in the PMO. Public servants began to fear that working in the Prime Minister's office, once seen as an essential developmental pathway, could limit their future public service careers. There may be more continuity in the PMO after a leadership succession, but maybe not this time. But even then, only a few former staff are likely to remain to serve the new Prime Minister. Now, this lack of institutional memory is a problem that recurs. There's also been a loss of institutional memory within departments because people there no longer have the experience of spending time understanding and working with the pressures. Now, the dilemma is illustrated by the experience of Prime Ministers Rudd, Gillard and Tony Abbott. All three struggled to make a successful transition to government, to gain or retain control over their agenda, to coordinate their policies and to project discipline and coherence across their ministerial teams. Such difficulties are often attributed to the pace and complexity of contemporary leadership and to fragmentation and all the things that I've talked about. Now, we acknowledge the contextual and contingent factors that undermine leaders' efforts to assert central control and the primacy of coping and survival in the face of uncertainty and the omnipresent threat of what we call rude surprises, which kind of happen every day. But we argue that a lack of institutional memory and the associated failure to learn from experience of their predecessors, and together with their lack of organisational capacity, are factors that we also need to start talking about. And particularly when we're assessing leaders' ability to make the most of the political capital that's available to them during the early stages of their tenure. Now, the problems and pathologies of a lack of institutional memory in the White House and the problems that can cause a president are actually well recognised among practitioners and scholars of the presidencies. And indeed, a White House's need for experience has also penetrated the public consciousness. The penultimate episode of The West Wing was entitled Institutional Memory. In it, the president-elect, Jimmy Smits, offered his predecessor, Chief of Staff C.J. Craig, a position as special counsel in his fledgling administration. As she tried, unsuccessfully as it turned out, to extract transition memos from outgoing Bartlett senior staff, the president-elect explained that he wanted to avoid having to reinvent the wheel. It was fiction, but the sentiment was apt. Now, the lack of institutional memory available to Australian Prime Ministers is comparatively recent, and it's a problem of their own making. We argue their decision to make the changes and to evolve this hybrid advisory arrangement without thinking through the consequences has indeed caused them some significant problems. And there's an energetic debate on whether to appoint public servants, which what we'd call the principal-private secretary tradition, or political staffers to the chief of staff position. A balance must be struck between public sector experience and networks and expertise on the one hand, and political, broadly defined, and communication skills and networks on the other. Some of our chiefs of staff were concerned that the pendulum of responsiveness might have swung too far. Some favoured changes that would focus on long-term policy and greater input from the public service. That hasn't been the trajectory of recent governments, so tensions remain. We can be certain, though, that despite the lamentation of the Business Council of Australia and Terry Moran and others about the rise of teenage ministerial staffers, that there is no going back. The pressures to cope and survive are intense, and public servants can't do many of the things that the modern chiefs of staff need to do. But it may be worth considering alternatives to the current model. And so we think the next phase of public sector reform really needs to focus on ways of helping prime ministers and their chiefs of staff to preserve institutional memory. Now, I mentioned that the research on this book was conducted in 2009, and I might have explained that the delay in publication was due to the Rudd and Gillard years, and it sort of further highlighted the importance of PM's Chiefs of Staff and an effective Prime Minister's office. So the way we resolved that dilemma of what to do with that experience was by road testing the Chiefs of Staff 8 lessons through the prism of the Gillard and Rudd years. Our aim here was to understand the importance of the Chief of Staff to Prime Ministerial effectiveness. We concluded that in different ways, Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard and their Chiefs of Staff offended or failed to observe each of the 8 lessons. In Rudd's case, we attribute that to extreme personality, whereas for Gillard, the issue was extreme contingency, and people will have views about that. But I think it's significant, in light of recent developments, to appreciate that concerns about the operation of Tony Abbott's private office began very early in the Prime Minister's tenure. As early as December 2013, just weeks into the Prime Ministership, rumblings began about the operation and style of the Abbott office. We noted this at the time. If you've read the book, you'll know we begin with a review of those criticisms that only grew and developed, reaching a crescendo in February, and then in the bitter aftermath again of Tony Abbott's removal a month or so ago. Now, I've argued elsewhere, and it was hard to judge in December 2013, that criticisms of control freakery by Prime Minister's office have become so common as to almost be routine. That they persisted beyond the first year of government and have contributed to the demise of 3 Prime Ministers indicates a structural problem in our governance that warrants our attention, I think. Rudd, Gillard and Abbott struggled, I think, because of a lack of effective transition planning, difficulty shifting from campaigning to governing, and an apparent incapacity to understand and find ways of navigating the realities of dependency and relationships in government. So if anything, the persistence of those difficulties into the Abbott years only reinforces my view about the problems of institutional memory and the inability or perhaps the unwillingness to learn from experience. And there was quite a bit of evidence, I think, of a lack of priority setting and agenda control and all the things I've talked about. The symptoms of that deeper malaise were evident in leaks, as well as in numerous examples of ministers and officials being blindsided by decisions taken without consultation in an increasingly insular and isolated PMO. Now, whether Malcolm Turnbull can give effect to the commitments that he's made to restore cabinet government, to consult more effectively, and to use my words, to better manage his dependencies remains to be seen. He's made what looks to be a promising start, but then so did Kevin Rudd, so the devil will be in the detail. Now, if we've learned anything in this research into Prime Minister's Chiefs of Staff, it's that an effective Chief of Staff and Prime Minister's office are a necessary, but they're not sufficient condition for a successful tenure. They can help prime ministers to do whatever they want to do and with how to do it. What they can't do is stand in for a prime minister who doesn't know what they want to do or how to achieve it. Now, the chief of staff may be only one actor in a web of relationships surrounding the prime minister, but they're a crucial node in an elite network that makes public policy decisions through setting the terms on which the rest of government interacts with the prime minister and his or her agenda. The job of the chief of staff is to help the prime minister lead, but leadership has many faces. The chief of staff and the prime minister must understand, must develop a common understanding of what kind of support they need in their particular context and at their particular time. And Gerard, I might finish there.
So many thanks to our speaker. As I said, Gatekeepers, Lessons from the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, which Professor Tiernan co-wrote with Professor R.A.W. Rhodes. There are copies over there, and I'm sure our speaker would be happy to do it. I think we've made a right judgment tonight. We brought the edition that's suitable for the hoi polloi.
I think you'd have liked the other one.
The one that's selling in the universities. I'm told if you take it to the football and stand on it, you get a better view. But I could barely open it. So thanks for that. I notice your research is done to 2009, and the one person who you didn't speak, who clearly wouldn't speak to you, was Tony Nutt, right?
Yes.
I think he's the smartest guy in the book. I just wonder. I mean, because the others are much more recent, but beyond your period of research. It just seems to me that people who are talking about their role will have a reason to say it was more important than what it was. As somebody who worked around Canberra for quite a number of years, I always thought that the role of the Chief of Staff and other staff was exaggerated. They got too much praise if it all went well for the government and too much blame if it all went badly for the government. And I always thought that the people overwhelmingly responsible for what went well and what went bad were the political leaders themselves, not the people for whom they worked. But do you think they spoke their book a bit, or do you think they told you the absolute truth?
It was very interesting to watch them hold each other accountable because they were in the room together, often with people from rival political parties and often from rival factions, as you'll remember some of those leadership changes. So I think I mentioned that it was, you know, one but not the only strategy that they used. Tony Nutt and I had a very amusing exchange that went kind of along the lines that you just described, Gerard. And maybe he will turn out to be the smartest guy in the book. But actually his experience both in Canberra and in Victoria with Baillieu would be very interesting to understand how people can do a job like that for so long. So I think he didn't... I think, you know, there are several people who we weren't able to involve in the book for different reasons. We never try and talk to the incumbent. It's really unfair, I think, to try to talk to the incumbent without the benefit of some time to reflect away from the job. And they do describe the time after leaving the job, or at least Arthur did, as like getting out of prison, because it's such a, you know, it's so relentless and you're so exhausted by the time that you're finished. So he'd be welcome to be in the second edition if he could change his mind.
Yes, the others who didn't, Alistair Jordan, Anne Manfing and Ben Hubbard, they were beyond it, so they weren't offered the opportunity for obvious reasons. Anne?
Just going back to your point about experience and institutional whatever architecture, Julie Gillard was for a long time Chief of Staff of Premier John Brumby, and I'm wondering why it was that she wasn't more aware in terms of, I mean, when the chips are down, the person who's the Premier or the Prime Minister ought to be the one in charge of the office.
Yeah.
And did you find out why it was that her experience with Brumby translate to having a better time in Canberra, even though the chief staff may not have
that. Sure, and I think it's a great question. And this is one of the issues about I think there's something about leaders, so I think Gerard's spot on. The chief of staff is going to be as effective as the leader who they work for. They can't substitute for the leader's own capacity. But what we know about contemporary leaders is that they're spending less time in Parliament before they become leader. So that's an issue, I think, in terms of their socialisation and understanding of the role. There's also a very big difference between state and federal government, as Tony Nutt found when he went the other way. The issues are very different, the networks are very different, the dependencies are very different. So this is actually a really interesting development of the political labour market that's developed, of people moving between jurisdictions and between traditions, because what works as a network in one place and as a strategy in one place may not work in another.
David Ball, the politicisation of the public service is very long-standing, and I think you can understand why it is that neither party would trust public service at the moment. The Liberal Party might not want to trust the public service because they're probably oppositional to what it is that they would like to achieve in many instances. And I think the Labour Party would be very distrustful of the public service because they would never be certain as to which the public servant would be loyal to in terms of factions. It becomes very, very difficult.
Yes. Okay. You respond?
Sure. So there are one of the lessons, I think, that that the Howard people learned was that they did cause themselves a lot of trouble by the Night of the Long Knives. And I think there was a view that that did deprive them of institutional memory and of skills and expertise to operate the machine. And, you know, I've spoken to people about that. And clearly there was much less of that kind of thing when the government changed. And indeed, Kevin Rudd committed to not, sacking secretaries and insisting that ministers would have 3 months to work with them. Of course, people made their own judgments about how they were going to work and with whom. And in fact, institutional memory wasn't available to Rudd in PM&C because Peter Shergold had decided that he was going to go. So, in fact, it's not always about sackings or distrust. Sometimes it's just about people saying, hey, my contract's up and, I want to do something else. But when you don't have a lot of experience from... I'm not suggesting that you shouldn't have chiefs of staff of political officers. You can't go back. But if you take everything to yourself and then you can't rely or you don't engage with the public service, it leaves you pretty short on capacity and experience to do things. Particularly if people don't have networks and understanding of how to get things done in government.
Question here, then we go down the back, yes?
During your work on this research, did you come to any conclusion as to how there would be a learning institute or teaching or anything that would help these people?
Yes, yes.
Did you come to any conclusion there would be a process that would help new chiefs of staff?
Yeah, sure. And indeed, I look to America for this kind of thing, by virtue of the fact that they do this in a non-partisan way. So a big and privately funded initiative was put together in the 2000s called the White House Transition Project, and it collected. It had presidential scholars from all over the country, from all sides of politics, who developed a huge repository of interviews, of analysis, of different presidencies of the job. So there's detailed discussions of, the press secretary job or this job or that job, the national security advisor job. So there's a scholars network that was funded, and practitioners saw it as their responsibility to be part of it. Now, of course, they have a transition period of government in which to think about how they want to run things, and they have transition teams who think those things through. We don't do that in Australia. Now, whether that would ever be acceptable in Australia, I'm not sure. But certainly it... there's a big premium when you're in the chief of staff job or in a minister's job to, I'm elected or I'm here, therefore I am. They're very competitive, and people don't want to say, I don't know how to do this. And they've been very resistant, actually, and I think understandably, to the advice of people who haven't been there. So I see that as an opportunity, and we thought we were making a modest contribution to that.
I'm wondering what you thought of the comment that Bill Gretlin made a couple of weeks ago at the Women Reading function, where said about our things like saying that, if you found the growth being too tough, then maybe you're on the wrong job. Is that symptomatic of, a chief of staff having too big an ego? And so the related question is...
Well, hang on. I think we'll stop there. I'll just repeat that so it gets picked up in the podcast.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It's a question about Peter Credlin's comment that if you get intimidated by the chief of staff, you're probably in the wrong job.
Right. Well, of course, it's very unusual for a chief of staff to have the right of reply. She's probably the first one to have done it so soon after her tenure. The others waited quite a long time, participate and be quoted in our book or in interviews with the ABC or whatever. So I think it's quite interesting. And a lot of the chiefs of staff in our study were concerned about the public role. about a much more public identification of people who are essentially surrogates of the PM. So what do I make of her comments? Well, it's fascinating for me as a researcher, of course, fantastic stuff. But I think it tells you that there is there clearly has been a very significant focus on her, whether that's because of the way the job was performed or the way the Prime Minister, because the Prime Minister decides how the job's performed, actually, how that was done, or whether it is a gender issue. She's only the third woman to ever have held the job. The other two had very short, unsuccessful and unhappy tenures in the role. So I don't contest that. But there was clearly a dynamic that was there from the beginning, as there was, although more attributable to the leader, I think, in the Rudd years. You know, the view of the Gillard years is they just really couldn't get over the, you know, they just couldn't manage in the constant contingency of the things that were going on around them. So it wasn't, you know, and I mean, this political time is a really important thing too. You know, these jobs are very hard. The fit is very difficult. But clearly there was something in the way that job was and the way it was being done was construed by others in the party. And if you can't keep people on side, then that's a problem.
Next question here. You mentioned many times about the loss of collective memory. Is the decision-making process of governments too influenced by the ideology? And should not there be a particular approach to involve business, which has a wonderful collective memory, to see a case for and against whatever they're proposing to do? Then they can make a decision on the basis of the input from people who have real collective memory.
Yeah, it's interesting because that view is often put, but Cabinet's not a board. And despite the many attempts to construe it that way, it doesn't really work that way. Now, are there other ways of managing decision processes, of disciplining decision processes? That's a really important piece of work. And when you have... Arthur Sinodinos talked a lot about how important the Howard Cabinet Policy Unit was in alleviating pressure on the day-to-day operations of the Prime Minister's office and to do a lot of the dealing with the bureaucracy. And that left, that took a big weight off him as Chief of Staff for 9 years. So, I think some of that thinking was influenced by people like Michael Lestrange and Paul McClintock, who did bring views about how you would discipline decision processes. So I'm not sure it's directly translatable, but I think there are parallels, and I think there have been efforts. And so this is, will be very interesting for me as an analyst to see whether Turnbull puts back the Cabinet Policy Unit that Labor abandoned because it didn't agree that it was an appropriate thing. And I think that accounts for some of the difficulties. Because the rest of the system adapts to how the Prime Minister's office is working. So for 11 years, Prime Minister and Cabinet wasn't doing things that were done in the Cabinet Policy Unit. Then Rudd couldn't understand why he couldn't get it back straight away. It just doesn't work like that.
So the Cabinet Policy Office operated in Parliament House during Howard's time,
right.
Independent from... although close to the Prime Minister's.
Mm. And it took the responsibility for long-term strategy.
My name is Peter Reid. Following your theme about the loss of institutional memory, we've had a concrete example in this latest change of PM, where apparently it was reported that the PM's official diary was unavailable for the first week of Turnbull's incumbency. Now, this comes back to putting in place transition arrangements. Surely there should be some basic understandings as to what is non-negotiable and should be available whenever there's a change of leader.
Well, some conventions.
We have to be fair to everyone here. I mean, that was an allegation in the media. Mm. I think it was only an allegation. Mm. I thought it was a pretty substantial beat-up in the Sydney Morning Herald. I mean, you can respond, but I'm not sure whether that's correct or not.
I'm not sure if it is, but I think there is. You know, there was a time when it would have been the public service who was handling that.
Yeah.
And I think this is the issue around conventions. And we do need to, though they're really important and they work because people respect them. So if that allegation is true, and I have no empirical insight into whether it is or not, but I do think it's very important that the public service is involved in those transitional arrangements for the reasons that everybody would understand. Yeah.
I'd like you to expand on the role you mentioned of protecting the Prime Minister, because that was a free role by their own party in 5 years.
Yeah.
And how important is it for the PMO to be out there and have the intelligence to what's going on? Because Tony Abbott was surprised by when he came back to Australia in the beginning by Ben Rolle.
Yes, which is surprising, isn't it? So, I mean, one of the things that's been put to me is that perhaps the parties have hollowed out in a way that wasn't the case under Hawke or Keating. They always had a political fixer, someone who was responsible for managing those kinds of relationships. So Tony Nutt really played that role for John Howard very effectively, kept the lines of communication open with the backbench, was really on to things. So the question is why that wasn't the case, why, as seems to be the case, that wasn't the case. And it's something that we need to look into. Is it because the parties aren't bringing through people like that anymore? Is it about, you know, and this has been suggested to us too, maybe these are jobs for young people now. It's so relentless. It's just, you know, the kinds of people with deep experience might not be prepared to do the kinds of hours that they entail. So, you know, I mean, Arthur was in that job for 9 years. It's pretty amazing, but that's the longest tenure. It's a much shorter average tenure than that. But there is, I think, something in the... These more recent officers seem to have been more hierarchical and less co-equal, a less clear, you know, division of responsibility. This is a very complex thing. If you think you can do it yourself as an individual chief of staff, I think you're kidding yourself. So I think it's something that, you know, is worth thinking about.
A bit different with others, isn't it? I think he lived in Canberra, didn't he? He had his home in Canberra, which most of the others have lived in Melbourne or Sydney, which puts much greater burden on people. Now, there was a question here, and then there.
Look, you touched on it earlier. Your analytic, your pre-analytic vision for your research, can you go back to that? You talked about the US and that, because that will affect the frames you've used on your research. So I'm very keen to hear about that.
Yep. So what I was interested in was seeing whether people who'd done the job would come together to talk about it. And so in recruiting them for the task, I wrote to them with a background paper saying, this is, you know, how they've done it in America. This is what's understood as the benefits for institutional memory. Would you be interested in being part of the discussion? These are the terms of engagement. I'm not a journalist. I don't want to know. I want to know about the work. That's what I want to know. So I was really pleased when they came in and were prepared to do that. Now, so in terms of what I thought needed to be covered in the issues, that was influenced by the two studies that had been done in America that had shown quite interestingly, actually, that where a president was at mattered, like what they needed at transition was actually different from what they needed facing re-election. So we asked them explicitly about different phases of the governing cycle. I mean, you're a new prime minister once. Graham Evans talked about how after a while, Hawke didn't want to hear certain stuff anymore. So he wanted to, you know, read, I know that, mate, you know, let's go on to the next thing. So it can be an issue for the chiefs of staff knowing that, they've got that, how do we move on to the next thing? So those were the kinds of frames that we used. And then in terms of the organisational concepts that we used to analyse their contributions, that was very much drawn from the interpretive political science, which is about meaning and how people make meaning from what they're doing. And so we use their words to come through. And, you know, the headings, the lessons, that all uses their words.
Yeah. Question down
there. You mentioned the figure for the PMO's office of, what, 58?
Yeah.
That's a pretty big team to run.
That's a very big team to run.
Is that appropriate, or could it be culled?
So the suggestion is that the Prime Minister's office at around 58, 59 is too large.
Well, you know, Prime Ministers decide how many staff resources they allocate to themselves under the Members of Parliament Staff Act. There's been a pretty constant trajectory of accretion and increase. And what is interesting is the kinds of jobs that people do. So they're responding to often environmental changes. So, you know, a very significant growth in people doing advance work or people doing social media work, which you wouldn't have had in a different age. And what happens is if you try as a new Prime Minister to take some of those things away, often the gallery or somebody else will get very upset with you. So the actual configuration of Prime Minister's offices have remained pretty consistent, really, in the modern era. And, you know, there's a few variations. The Cabinet Policy Unit was a particular configuration. Rudd made an election commitment. Well, actually, Lindsay Tanner made an announcement at the National Press Club that became an election commitment, which was that they were going to cut ministerial staff numbers by 30% in 2007, which gave them a real problem because, you know, the expectations were there and the workload was there. So they, you know, the Prime Minister's office might have shrunk a little tiny bit, but not generally. those savings were found in other ministers' offices. It won't surprise you to learn. So is it too big? Look, I think it's an organisational issue and I think it's a management challenge. The point of having a personal staff was to extend your capacity to do things. The accountability dilemma and the performance management dilemma of having a bunch of people running around speaking in your name is the one that, of course, became very problematic in the presidency and has been much written about.
Yes, I wonder if you may have answered this in some way. Too many people perhaps are going into Parliament and into government who have got a good academic background and never actually done a job where you had to make something happen. You're great on communicating.
Sure.
You don't know how you get other human beings to function.
The question is whether too many people are going into Parliament who don't have real life experience running.
So this is the debate about the rise of the career politician. It's a live one. And it's one that lots of people have raised. There's a big debate about it in the UK. When Pat and I did the book in 2010, Learning to Be a Minister, we looked at the backgrounds of lots of the people who'd come in under Labor, and we dealt with the outgoing Howard people and the incoming Rudd people. And I guess the dilemma as a researcher is people have got, very strong intellectual backgrounds, if they've, done some interesting things, albeit in a narrow frame, can you say, oh, well, they're not going to be good at their job? I mean, I think that's quite a hard thing to do. I think maybe a better way of answering the question is, who's performing well? Who are the leaders who are seen to be performing well? And they're John Key, and they're Mike Baird, and they're people who seem to have done some other things in their lives. So I think, I don't think it needs me to offer an academic opinion on that. I think clearly becoming a minister, I think the staffer career was never intended to be a long-term one, and that's how it's evolved. It was intended to be a short, temporary thing, and this career has grown, and it's natural that people might want to, pursue pre-selection or whatever through that pathway. Whether it might be better is something for parties to decide, I think, in terms of their pre-selection processes.
Thank you for your presentation. You speak of institutional memory and the role of transition, but is it not the case in our system, unlike the United States, where a lot of our parliamentarians are former staffers themselves, and three of our last four prime ministers, or four of the last five, depending on how you count, were staffers themselves in different guises? I mean, it's just information flows in different ways. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think I'd reiterate the point about, Kevin Rudd having been a junior DFAT officer, a political staffer to Wayne Goss in Queensland, the head of the Cabinet Office, and then, MP and Prime Minister, is not a terribly diverse career pathway and probably didn't give him the insight that he might have thought he had into the Canberra bureaucracy. And that's not me drawing that conclusion. That's, I think, a widespread view among Canberra bureaucrats. I think that institutional memory is about how things should be done, about how things have happened in the past. So an experience, say, Julia Gillard from Victoria, might be parallel, but where do you go looking for how we handled this last time? Who knows about how we did this in the past? Now, I'm confounded by Tony Abbott's experience because he had access to the institutional memory of the Howard years. And the narrative of the Howard years is that it worked very well after the first sort of 18 months, got the show on the road and it was working really well. So the interesting question to me is, so institutional memory may be also about what you want to access. And there's a fair bit of organisational forgetting that people do for different reasons. So that's what I'm actually very interested in that as an idea. I don't think you can assume it exists in the public service the way people might imagine it once did, accounting for the fact that there was never a golden age and all that. There's clearly much more turnover. There's clearly much more movement. Lots of people are concerned about record keeping and all those kinds of issues. So it's about how people access it, I think.
You have a new model with Arthur Sinodinos now, too.
Indeed. And, that's a continuity that goes back to the 80s. So he has a lot. So it'll be really interesting to see what, if any, difference that makes.
Sure. Is there a difference between the skill set of a chief of staff in opposition as opposed to government? And should there, if there is, should there be a turnover?
Well, this would be the conclusion from the American literature. So the Americans would talk about the need for the campaign team to give way to the transition team because the skills of campaigning and winning the day and all that stuff are different to the skills of governing. And this is widely debated in the American literature. People have been less inclined to do that in our system because, of course, it's a reward for the terrible years in opposition. Right. Wrong, down. Sad.
Right down the back.
Probably the most controversial characteristic that Tony Abbott made was the giving of the AC to Prince Philip. What do you think that said about Peter Crevin's role as his chief of staff? I don't know if you would argue that somebody in that position should be in place of confidence.
Well, the question is about the knighthood to Prince Philip and the suggestion that Peter Credlin had a role, but as Anne suggested, the view was that Peter Credlin was opposed to that decision.
Well, I haven't done the research into that. I can tell you that the Queensland LNP weren't too happy about it, smack bang in the middle of their election campaign. That's what I can tell you from Brisbane. I don't know. Prime ministers decide. Everybody else advises.
What if it's briefing taken? Yeah,
it's a brief one. The medical profession has to have kind of regular educational through the year. If we have no one or very few people in government who have business experience, should not our politicians be exposed to business people on a regular basis so they at least have an understanding of how it works?
The question is whether politicians should be exposed to business people.
Subject to continuing professional development. I think they decide about that. I think people will take the professional development that they think they need to. I doubt they don't get much exposure to business people. I think they get quite a bit.
Okay,
knocking on their
door.
I just
want to
ask, what's happened to the yes Prime Minister model? Because we've all watched Yes Prime Minister and Yes Minister, and that's very much the British civil service, where the head of the department, the public servant, is very much the person who manages the office.
Yeah.
And I had a row with someone on TV recently about the fact that she was saying that we have to get the public service back into the office of the Prime Minister. And I just really
yeah, see, I don't buy that either. I'm with you, Anne, but maybe not for the reason you think. There is no going back. They're not going back. Prime Ministers are not going to relinquish the capacity to decide who they have around them. What I think, and David Epstein raised this with us in the workshop that we did in 2009, that, you know, we had a debate in the 1980s about what was the appropriate way of organising a new and more responsive public service. And there was a debate about whether we should have politically appointed senior executives or whether we'd go down the ministerial staff model. We opted for the ministerial staff model. I think it's outlived its usefulness to the extent that it doesn't deal with some of the things that we're talking about. And it's too ambiguous and vague, and practices outstrip theory and all that kind of stuff. So I think that one of the things that Epstein suggested is, well, should you really split the role into the person who does the supporting and protecting the Prime Minister and the person who runs the office? That's not impossible. Malcolm Turnbull's taken Drew Clark, his departmental secretary, into his office, and Tiny Nutt's down there helping, and, so we'll have to see how that goes. Rod and I are working on a comparative project at the moment, looking at four Westminster-style countries of the central executives of four Westminster-style countries, and then we're contrasting Queensland and Victoria, which is a million laughs. But maybe not for the reasons that you think. So we're doing that, and one of the things that's really, really interesting is the extent to which the political court immediately around the Prime Minister, doesn't necessarily think that the public service needs to be in the room. And that's clear in Canada, and it's clear in Australia, and it's probably been the case for a while in some jurisdictions, but I was surprised at the extent to which that was the case in Canada. Of course, it's not the case in New Zealand and the UK. So that's a bit of a worry, I think. And we have to get... I mean, what I've been trying to do... The presidential studies literature will tell you that people have been... Academics have been writing books for presidents they've been ignoring since the 1930s. So I've always taken the view that we need to give them things that they think are useful to them, and then they can decide what to do with them. I think we need to persuade them that they're not well served by the model that they've got now. Now, I've been trying to do that for 8 years, but I don't know that I've succeeded yet. But, I'm interested to see what Turnbull does, because he's talking this language of something different. So we'll have to see.
Many thanks. Our program didn't turn up tonight, but it's on our website if anyone wants to check what's going on. As I said, the gatekeepers... for people like us, is available, and I'm sure Anne's happy to sign it. I think the reason why the book works and the reason why Anne's talk worked today and the reason why I'm sure her students are very grateful to her teaching, is that she doesn't have a background as political staffer, but she does have a background in the public service, starting off in Canberra and then working with the Queensland government. It's consulted a lot. And so what came out tonight was that our speaker has a very clear understanding about how government, broadly defined, operate, and many academics don't. And I think the analysis works because of that understanding, which makes the book a valuable contribution. And I'm sure there will be another edition, the way things are changing. You've probably got the rest of your career just revising this book. And we'll see when we get Tony Nutt to talk to you. Have a talk to Tony.
That'd be great.
But for tonight, congratulations and well done.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.